From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Pity the plastic shopping bag, once a modern convenience, now an environmental villain. The non-biodegradable bags have been banned in San Francisco, and now Seattle is trying to discourage the use of the bags. It is levying a 20-cent fee. But, as NPR's Martin Costi tells us, the city's new policy is running into a surprising amount of resistance.
Seattle supermarkets have become the scene of some unusual political theater. Here outside the Thriftway, for example, there's a woman wearing a suit made of old plastic bags.
Is that warm?
I'm not fully encased in it, so no.
So tell me your name.
Michelle Gaither.
Gaither is a member of Cool Moms, one of the groups campaigning against the bags. Another mom uses the presence of the plastic bag monster to create a teachable moment.
And it ends up in the water, and it ends up in the ocean. And dolphins don't like it, and fish don't like it.
What do fish don't like?
Last month, it looked as if Seattle environmentalists had won their battle against the bag monster. The city council imposed a 20-cent fee on all disposable bags, as well as a ban on to-go containers made of foam. But that victory may be fleeting.
Hello, are you guys voters? Would you like to sign to put the grocery bag fee to a vote?
Outside a nearby Safeway, Abraham Salazar gathers signatures to put the bag fee to a citywide vote. He's paid up to $2 per signature. The petition drive is being paid for by business interests, including the American Chemistry Council, which represents bag makers. Salazar says people have been eager to sign.
A lot of people are more opposed to the shopping bag fee than you would think from a progressive city like Seattle.
Eric Slauson signs the petition. He says he doesn't like the city council's judgment that people who use plastic bags are being unecological.
We never throw away our plastic bags. We reuse them for everything around the house, our cats, our baby, everything else, you know, to clean up. So recycle, reuse, right?
People in Seattle tend to resent the implication that they're not being green enough, and the local grocery store association is keying in to that resentment. The Washington food industry, as it's called, is co-sponsoring the petition drive. The grocers say they would rather reward people a few cents at a time for bringing in reusable bags, and they say the city's approach of imposing a fee is too heavy-handed. It's an argument that surprises Brady Montz. He's the chair of the local Sierra Club, and he says some of his members thought the bag fee was too soft.
They want to go stronger. They want to ban. And, you know, we're trying to talk those people down.
Montz says the bag fee is all about letting people decide.
You're not controlling what people can and can't do. If you want to use it, use it. If it has a cost, pay it. You expose the cost to people, then they can make their own decision about, on this time, is it worth it for me to buy it? Yes or no.
But there are plenty of Seattleites who see the fee, or the tax, as opponents call it, as an imposition, not a choice. The Grocers Association says the signatures are coming in fast, and if it collects enough, the bag fee won't take effect until voters have their say. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Simon. Global temperatures are likely to rise 2 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit this century. But those are just yearly averages. Extreme temperatures are likely to rise much more, according to a new study. The study suggests that heavily populated parts of the world, including the middle of the United States, could face heat waves where the temperature soars above 120 Fahrenheit. NPR's Richard Harris has this story on the study and what its findings could mean.
Most of the time, when scientists talk about global warming, they talk about how much the average global temperature will rise. An average includes nights, winters, north, and south.
We looked at the extreme temperatures because those are the temperatures that we really suffer from.
Andreas Sturl and his colleagues are at the Dutch Meteorological Institute, and when they looked at what the highest highs are likely to be at the end of this century, they came back with some oppressive figures. The peak highs in Europe could go from a sweltering 100 degrees up to 110 or 115. And there's even some chance the figure could breach Sahara Desert-style highs in the 120s.
If it's only one day and then it's cool afterwards, it's not a problem. But usually these heat waves, they last some days. and then it's becoming a health problem.
Sterl's study is published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. It finds that by the end of the century, temperatures in the 120s could strike Australia and the American Midwest.
What I'm personally very concerned about is Middle East and northern India. It's a heavy populated area, and it's already very hot there today, but it will become much hotter there. So they will experience in large parts of that areas temperatures that reach 120, 125 degrees Fahrenheit.
At least in the United States, most people can retreat into air conditioning. Michael Greenstone, an environmental economist at MIT, did a study showing, as a result, a rise in summer temperatures would not have that great an impact here. Even agriculture can weather the occasional high heat wave, his studies show. But he says the story's different in India.
And there, it's not very easy for people to turn on the air conditioning or to pick up and move just because they don't have as many resources. And my preliminary research on India suggests that the impacts on mortality could be quite dramatic.
Horrible heat waves could lead to mass fatalities, he says. And agriculture is also likely to suffer more in places like India, where it is a large fraction of the economy.
I think what is becoming clear and clear is that the costs of climate change are not going to be spread evenly around the globe. Unfortunately, they're going to be concentrated in the countries that are least capable of dealing with them, just due to low income levels.
That means there are really two avenues to pursue in order to prevent massive heat deaths in the coming decades. One is to try to reduce emissions to slow the pace of climate change. The other is to improve the standard of living for people who are poor so they can better cope with the heat.
Changes in temperature are not going to occur overnight. And so there will be a lot of time to adapt.
Adapt, we might, but we may never get used to afternoon high temperatures that are now found only on the planet's hottest deserts. Richard Harris, NPR News.
On our website, you can find a related story about how one group of people has adapted to extreme temperatures. Hear about the nomads of West Africa's Sahel and see pictures at npr.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. There are hundreds of dead zones in the world's coastal oceans. Dead zones are bottom waters that don't have enough oxygen to support marine life. In the latest issue of the journal Science, researchers have identified 405 dead zones, and they say that these polluted waters are now the leading threat to life in coastal oceans. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Taken together, the 405 dead zones cover 95,000 square miles, an area the size of New Zealand. The biggest dead zone found in U.S. waters appears every summer in the Gulf of Mexico. The biggest one in the world is in the Baltic Sea in northern Europe, and it lasts almost all year round. The newest global count is the work of Robert Diaz, a marine biologist at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. He says most of the dead zones are found near crowded coastlines in the northern hemisphere.
So you have Europe, heavily populated with dead zones, North America, heavily populated, Japan is virtually covered with them, and now we're seeing reports coming out of China, India, and even the Middle East, where dead zones seem to be a problem there, too.
Diaz says dead zones are usually found near the mouths of rivers polluted by fertilizers. Nutrients in these fertilizers feed big algae blooms that die and sink to the ocean bottom. The bacteria that feeds on this dead algae takes most of the oxygen out of the water. The first scientific reports of dead zones appeared in 1910, says Diaz. There were only four that year.
If you go into the literature prior to the 60s, 1960s, you don't find very many accounts of systems with low oxygen. And even in some systems today that have really big problems with oxygen, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, these are the areas where model communities were described for the invertebrate fauna. And now they have oxygen problems.
Diaz says his research seems to show that the number of dead zones in the world's oceans has been doubling every 10 years since the 1960s. But he also says it hasn't been easy to draw attention to the problems posed by these dead zones. Several years ago, when scientists located what's now known as the world's largest dead zone in the Baltic Sea, Diaz says local fishermen paid no attention to the warnings of hypoxic or oxygen-free waters. They also ignored predictions that the sea life living in these waters would soon begin to flee or die.
Then one year, the fishermen reported record catches of Norway lobsters, and they just laughed at the scientists, saying, no, there's no problem here. Well, what they didn't know, the fishermen that is, they were catching hypoxia-stressed animals, and that was it. They caught them that year, and after that, the fisheries collapsed in this area, and it is still not recovered.
Jane Lubchenco, a marine biologist and dead zone expert at Oregon State University, hopes this survey will get people's attention.
It really says that dead zones are increasing exponentially around the world, that it's likely they're going to increase in the future, but also that we can go in a different direction, that the problem could be addressed.
Lubchenco and others say dead zones can be fixed and in some cases have been fixed. For example, runoff rules have helped keep fertilizers out of New York's Hudson River, she says. That, in turn, has helped shrink the dead zones found near the mouth of the Hudson River.
Over a billion people a day depend on seafood for their sole or primary source of protein. Dead zones are increasingly threatening these very productive waters, and it behooves us to do everything we can to make sure that those areas are as healthy and productive as possible. And in this case, that means reducing the flow of nutrients to them.
But Diaz says he worries that dead zones may soon start spreading beyond the northern hemisphere. That's because agriculture development in the southern hemisphere could mean those countries will start using more fertilizers in the years to come.
The real problem there is South America. It has a climate and a land mass with a similar fertility to North America. And as agriculture and population expand there, I suspect we'll see a lot of dead zones being reported. Even along the coast of Chile with the development of aquaculture, there are a number of new accounts that didn't even get into our study that are there now.
Diaz says the spread of these dead zones is happening so fast that it outstrips all of the other problems facing the world's oceans. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.